Something new turned up every day, and many mysteries became commonplaces, but not all. One thing had certainly changed in our situation. We were no longer outsiders. We belonged. The bathing season had come. Old and young, great and small flocked to the gardens by the river and enjoyed themselves swimming and paddling in the shallow water. Smart people organized comfortable picnic parties and put up their own tents. You could see many young women who had studied in India proudly displaying their modern bathing dresses. In the intervals of splashing about in the water, the bathers picnicked and played dice, and in the evening every party burned a stick of incense by the riverside in gratitude to the gods for a lovely day. I was much admired for my prowess as a swimmer. Tibetans do not know much about swimming, as the water is too cold for learning. Those who can swim at all can just keep themselves afloat. Now they had an expert among them. I was invited right and left, of course with the idea that I should show off my skill. But my sciatica made swimming a painful pastime, as the water was very cold, never above 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Sometimes I used to dive in order to give my friends pleasure, but not often. Still, there were times when my presence was of service. I managed to save 3 people from drowning, for there were some dangerous places in the river where obstructions had created whirlpools and undercurrents. One day I was the guest of Sir Kang, the foreign minister, and his family, who had put up their tent beside the water. The minister's only son Jigme, meaning dreadnought, was there on a holiday from school in India. He had learned how to swim, more or less, at school. I was floating downstream when I suddenly heard cries and saw people gesticulating wildly on the bank and pointing to the water. I hurriedly swam to land and ran to the tent. From there I saw Jigme being whirled round in a swirling eddy. I at once dived in, and though the whirlpool caught me, too, I was a strong swimmer and managed to get hold of the unconscious lad and bring him to the bank. As a former instructor, I knew how to revive him, and in a short time he was breathing again, to the great joy of his father, who shed tears and overwhelmed me with expressions of gratitude. I had saved a life, and that was accounted a great merit. As a result of this episode, my relations with the Sir Kang family became intimate, and I had an opportunity to study a marital combination that even in Tibet was quite out of the ordinary. The minister was separated from his first wife. The second, the mother of Jigme, was dead. Sir Kang now shared the young wife of a nobleman of lower rank. In the marriage contract, Jigme was brought in as the third husband, because his father did not wish to leave all his fortune to his widow. Similar complications are found in many families. I once came across a case in which a mother was the sister-in-law of her own daughter. In Tibet one finds polygamy and polyandry, but most people are monogamous. When a man has several wives, his relations with them are different from those that prevail in a Muslim harem. It is common practice for a man to marry several daughters of a house in which there is no son and heir. This arrangement prevents the family fortune from being dispersed. Our host Zarong had married 3 sisters and had obtained permission from the Dalai Lama to take their family name. In spite of the frequently unusual relationships created by these alliances, broken marriages are not commoner in Tibet than with us. This is largely due to the fact that these people are not inclined to let their feelings run away with them. When several brothers share the same wife, the eldest is always the master in the household and the others have rights only when he is away or amusing himself elsewhere. But no one gets short measure, as there is a superfluity of women. Many men live a celibate life in monasteries. There is a cloister in every village. The children of irregular alliances have no right to inherit, and all the property goes to the children of the legitimate wife. That is why it is not so important which of the brothers is the father of the child. The great thing is that the property remains in the family. Tibet knows nothing about the drawbacks of overpopulation. For centuries the number of inhabitants has remained about the same. In addition to the practices of polyandry and monasticism, infant mortality contributes to this state of things. I calculate that the average expectation of life among the Tibetans is only about 30 years. A great number of small children die, and among the whole mass of officials there is only one septuagenarian. I had read in many books about Tibet that the host is accustomed to offer his wife or daughter to his guest. If I had counted on that, I should have been badly disappointed. Sometimes it happened that a pretty young servant girl was light-heartedly offered to one, but the girls don't give themselves without being courted. Of course, loose girls can be found in all parts of the world, and even in Lhasa there are certain beauties who make love on a professional basis. In former times marriages were arranged by the parents, but today the young people choose their own partners. They marry very young, the girls at 16 and the boys at 17 or 18 at latest. The aristocracy may marry only in their own class, and this rule is strictly applied. Relatives may not marry each other except after 7 generations, in order to avoid inbreeding. The Dalai Lama alone may permit exceptions to these rules. Occasionally, capable men of the people are promoted to the nobility, and that brings a little fresh blood into the small circle of about 200 families that constitute the aristocracy. Divorces are rare and have to be approved by the government. Very drastic penalties are inflicted on unfaithful spouses, for example cutting off the nose. But, as a matter of fact, I never heard of a case where this punishment was carried out. They once showed me an old woman without a nose, who was alleged to have been detected in infidelity, but it might just as well have been a case of syphilis. Venereal disease is very common in Tibet. Many cases occur in Lhasa, but not much importance is attached to them. They are generally neglected, and the doctor is called in when it is too late to do much good. The ancient remedy of mercury is known to the monks in the schools of medicine. What a lot could be done for the future of Tibet if medical and sanitary conditions were improved. Surgery is completely unknown in the country. Orf Snater and I used to have a panic at the thought of an attack of appendicitis. Every suspicious pain used to alarm us. It seemed absurd in the 20th century to die of this illness. The Tibetans know nothing of operations on the human body except the lancing of boils. The use of instruments in confinements is likewise unknown. The only connection Tibetans have with surgery is in the activities of the people who dissect corpses, the Domdans. These often report to the relatives on the cause of death or inform interested students of medicine when they find any interesting feature in a corpse. The schools of medicine are unfortunately opposed to all progress. The doctrines taught by Buddha and his apostles are an overruling law, which may not be tampered with. There are 2 schools, the smaller situated on the Shagpuri or Iron Mountain, and the larger down below in the town. Every monastery sends a number of intelligent youngsters to these schools. The course lasts from 10 to 15 years. Learned old monks give instruction to the boys, who sit cross-legged on the ground with their tablets on their knees. Colored illustrations are often displayed on the walls. I was once present when a teacher was explaining by means of illustrations the symptoms of poisoning caused by a certain plant. The pupils were shown pictures of the plant, the symptoms, the antidotes and their reactions, just like the wall pictures in our schools. Astronomy is an integral part of medical science. The yearly lunar calendar is put together in the schools of medicine after old works have been consulted. Eclipses of the sun and moon are carefully recorded, and monthly and yearly weather forecasts prepared. In the autumn the whole school goes off to search for herbs in the mountains. The boys enjoy the expedition tremendously, though they are kept very busy. Every day they camp in a fresh place, and at the end of their excursion they drive their heavily laden yaks to Drayerpa. This is one of the holiest places in Tibet. It contains a sort of temple in which the herbs are sorted and laid out to dry. In winter the youngest of these little monks have to grind the dried herbs into powders, which are kept in carefully labeled, airtight leather bags by the abbot in charge of the school. These schools serve at the same time as pharmacies from which anyone can get medicine gratis or for a small present. The Tibetans are really advanced in the knowledge of herbs and their healing properties, and I have often had recourse to them. Their pills did not do my sciatica much good, but I staved off many a cold and fever with their herb teas. The abbot of the medical school of Lhasa is at the same time the Dalai Lama's personal physician, an honorable but dangerous charge. When the 13th Dalai Lama died at the age of 54, all kind of suspicions were openly voiced, and the abbot of the time could consider himself lucky to have escaped with loss of rank. He might have been sentenced to a flogging. In the towns and monasteries one can get oneself vaccinated against smallpox, but no other forms of inoculation are practiced, and many lives are lost needlessly in epidemics for want of prophylactic treatment. What saves Tibet is its cool climate and pure mountain air. But for them, the universal dirt and the wretched sanitary conditions would surely engender catastrophic plagues. In season and out we preached the necessity of better sanitation and had thought out a drainage scheme for Lhasa. Superstition is the enemy. We found that the people had more confidence in the laying on of hands and faith healing than in the ministration of the monks of the schools of medicine. The lamas often smear their patients with their holy spittle. Sampa, butter, and the urine of some saintly man are made into a sort of gruel and administered to the sick. The wooden prayer stamps, which are dipped in holy water and then applied to the painful spot, do no one any harm. Nothing ranks higher as a remedy for illness than objects that have belonged to the Dalai Lama. All the nobles used to show me with pride relics of the 13th Dalai Lama carefully sewn up in little silk bags. Zarong, as his former favorite, possessed many articles of personal use that had belonged to him, and it astonished me that Zarong and his son, who had been educated in India, were superstitious enough to set store by these relics. Many men and women live by fortune-telling and casting horoscopes. Characteristic of the streets of Lhasa are the little old women who crouch beside the pilgrim's road and tell the future for a small fee. They ask you the date of your birth, make a small calculation with the help of their rosaries, and you go on your way consoled by the mysterious words. The greatest confidence is placed in the soothsaying powers of lamas and incarnations. One does not do a thing without consulting the omens. No one would think of going on a pilgrimage or taking up a new office before ascertaining on what date it will be lucky to start. Not long ago there lived in Lhasa a very celebrated lama, whose visits and consultations were booked up for months ahead. He used to travel with his disciples from place to place receiving hospitality. His patients gave him so many presents that he and his group lived very comfortably on them. He had such a reputation that even Mr. Fox, the English radio operator, who for years had been a victim of gout, arranged for the Lama to visit him. But poor Fox missed his turn as the old man died before he could come. The old Lama had originally been a simple monk. After studying for 20 years in one of the greatest monasteries, he passed his examinations brilliantly and retired to a hermitage for several years. He lived in one of the lonely cells that one finds scattered over the whole country and in which monks settle down to a period of meditation. Many of them have themselves walled in by their disciples and live on nothing but sampa and tea. This monk became celebrated for his exemplary life. He never ate food which life had been taken to provide, and abstained even from eggs. He was reputed to need no sleep and never to use a bed. This latter detail I can confirm, as he once lived near me for 3 days. He was also said to perform miracles. Once his rosary caught fire from the powerful rays that emanated from his own hand. He presented to the town of Lhasa a great gilded statue of Buddha, which he paid for out of the gifts and contributions he had received from his patients and admirers. There was only one female incarnation in Tibet. Her name, as interpreted, was Thunderbolt So. I often used to see her at ceremonies in the parka. She was then an insignificant-looking student of about 16, wearing a nun's dress. However, she was the holiest woman in Tibet, and the people entreated her to bless them wherever she went. Later on she became abbess in a convent by Lake Yamdrok. Lhasa was always full of rumors and stories about saintly nuns and lamas, and I would gladly have investigated some of their miracles. But one must not offend against people's beliefs. The Tibetans were happy in their own convictions and had never tried to convert Ofsnator or me. We contented ourselves with studying their customs, visiting their temples as spectators, and making presents of white silk scarves as etiquette prescribed. Life in Lhasa, too. Just as the people apply to lamas and soothsayers for advice and help in the cares of daily life, so the government consults the state oracle before making important decisions. Once I asked my friend Wangjula to take me to an official consultation, and so one morning we rode out to the Nikhung Monastery. At that time a 19-year-old monk was the mouthpiece of the oracle. He was brought up in simple circumstances but had attracted much attention by his gifts as a medium. His technique was not so striking as that of his predecessor, who had cooperated in the discovery of the present Dalai Lama, but much was expected of him. I have often wondered whether it was by an unheard-of effort of concentration that he was able so quickly to throw himself into a trance before large crowds of people, or whether he used drugs or other expedients. In order to function as an oracle, the monk has to be able to dislodge his spirit from his body, to enable the god of the temple to take possession of it and to speak through his mouth. At that moment, the god is manifested in him. That is the belief of the Tibetans, and Wangjula was convinced of its truth. We talked about these things during our 5-mile ride to the cloister. Hollow, eerie music greeted us at the gate of the temple. Inside, the spectacle was ghastly. From every wall looked down hideous, grimacing faces, and the air was filled with stifling fumes of incense. The young monk had just been led from his private quarters to the gloomy temple. He wore a round metal mirror on his breast. Attendants robed him in gay silks and led him to his throne. Then everyone drew back from around him. No sound could be heard except the hollow music. He began to concentrate. I watched him closely, never taking my eyes from his face. Not the slightest movement of his features escaped me. He looked as if the life were fading out of him. Now he was perfectly motionless, his face a staring mask. Then suddenly, as if he had been struck by lightning, his body curved upward like a bow. The onlookers gasped. The god was in possession. The medium began to tremble. His whole body shook and beads of sweat stood out on his forehead. Servants went to him and placed a huge, fantastic headdress on his head. This was so heavy that it took 2 men to carry it. The slender body of the monk sank deeper into the cushions of the throne under the weight of his monstrous mitre. It is no wonder, I thought, that these mediums die young. The spiritual and physical strain of these seances must be killing. The trembling became more violent. The medium's heavily laden head wavered from side to side, and his eyes started from their sockets. His face was swollen and covered with patches of hectic red. Hissing sounds pierced through his closed teeth. Suddenly he sprang up. Servants rushed to help him, but he slipped by them and to the moaning of the oboes began to rotate in a strange exotic dance. Save for the music, his groans and teeth gnashings were the only sounds to be heard in the temple. Now he started beating on his gleaming breastplate with a great thumb ring, making a clatter that drowned the dull rolling of the drums. Then he gyrated on 1 foot, erect under the weight of the giant headdress, which just now 2 men could hardly carry. The attendants filled his hands with barleycorns, which he threw into the awestruck crowd of onlookers. All bent low before him, and I feared lest I be noted as an intruder. The medium became calmer. Servants held him fast, and a cabinet minister stepped before him and threw a scarf over his head. Then he began to ask questions carefully prepared by the cabinet about the appointment of a governor, the discovery of a new incarnation, matters involving war and peace. The oracle was asked to decide on all these things. Often the question had to be repeated several times before the medium began to mumble. I tried to pick out intelligible words but made nothing of the sounds. While the minister stood humbly there trying to understand the answers, an old monk took them down with flying pen. He had done this hundreds of times in his life, as he was also secretary to the late oracle. I could not prevent myself from suspecting that perhaps the real oracle was the secretary. The answers he wrote down, though ambiguous, suggested a line to be followed and relieved the cabinet of a heavy load of responsibility. When an oracle goes on giving bad advice, they make short work of the mouthpiece. He is relieved of his office. This always seemed to me illogical. Did the god speak through the medium or did he not? In spite of the risks, the post of state oracle is much sought after. It carries with it the office of Dalama, corresponding with the third rank in the orders of nobility, and its holder is prior of the cloister of Nikhung with all its benefices. The last questions put by the minister to the oracle remained unanswered. Was the medium exhausted, or was the god out of humor? I left the temple and stood in the blinding sunlight feeling quite benumbed by what I had seen. My European mentality was baffled at the experience. I subsequently attended many consultations of the oracle, but have never been able to arrive even at an approximate explanation of the riddle. It was always a curious experience to meet the state oracle in ordinary life. I could never get quite accustomed to sitting at the same table with him and hearing him noisily gulping his noodle soup. When we met in the street, I used to take off my hat, and he bowed and smiled in return. His face was that of a nice-looking young man, and bore no resemblance to the bloated, red-flecked, grimacing visage of the ecstatic medium. Another occasion on which the state oracle plays a great part is that of the so-called Great Procession, when the Dalai Lama is carried into the city to visit the cathedral. This ceremony is called the Great Procession to distinguish it from the procession to the Summer Garden, which I have already described. On this occasion the whole of Lhasa is afoot, there is hardly standing room anywhere. There is a tent pitched on a piece of open ground, and around it are stationed monkish guards, who as usual are engaged in keeping curious people back with their whips. This tent conceals a great mystery. In it the Dalama of Nikhung is preparing to go into a trance. In the meantime the god king is slowly approaching in his sedan chair with his 36 bearers. Now the Holy One has halted before the tent out of which the god-possessed monk reels with staggering steps. His face is swollen, hissing tones proceed from his mouth, and the weight of his headdress almost bears him to the ground. Waving the bearers aside, he breaks through the line and puts his shoulders under the shafts and runs for a few steps. He looks as though he were upsetting his holy burden, but all is well. The other bearers take the strain, and the Dalama falls to the ground in a faint and is carried off in a litter, which is waiting to receive him. The procession then proceeds on its stately way. I have never been able to understand the exact meaning of this ritual. Perhaps it is meant to symbolize the subjection of the protecting deity to the higher powers of the living Buddha. In addition to the state oracle and the rainmaker, there are in Lhasa at least 6 mediums, including an old woman who is reckoned to be a manifestation of a protecting goddess. She was prepared, for a small fee, to fall into a trance and allow the goddess to speak. On some days she went through this performance 4 times. There are also mediums who, while in a state of trance, can bend long swords into a spiral. Several friends of mine keep such swords lying before their house altars. I have made various attempts to emulate this feat, but could not begin to do it. The consultation of oracles originated in pre-Buddhistic times when the gods demanded human sacrifices, and I think the ritual has continued almost unchanged since early days. I was always deeply impressed by these uncanny performances, but was glad to think that my own decisions were not subject to the dictation of an oracle. By the time the autumn came, we had already been several months in Lhasa and were thoroughly acclimatized. This is the best season of the year. The flower gardens, in which I had done so much work, were in full bloom, and the trees had just begun to change color. There was fruit in abundance, peaches, apples, and grapes from the southern provinces. Splendid tomatoes and marrows were displayed in the market, and it was during this season that the gentry gave their great parties at which an unbelievable choice of delicacies was offered to their guests. It was also the right time of year for excursions, but unfortunately no Tibetan would climb a mountain for pleasure. On special days the monks go on a pilgrimage to some sacred mountain peak, and the nobles send their servants with them to propitiate the gods, to whom they burn incense on the summits. The windy mountain heights resound with prayers and new flags are put up, while crows fly around waiting to eat up the offerings of Sampa. It must be added that everyone is happy to be back in town after 2 or 3 days in the mountains, Ofsnator and I made a point of climbing all the peaks in the neighborhood. They offered no technical difficulties as an attraction, but the views from them were splendid. To the south we could see the Himalayas, and quite near us towered a 23,000-foot peak of the Nanshenthanala range, over which we had scrambled 8 months before on our way down to Lhasa. There are no glaciers to be seen from the town. The assumption that one finds snow and ice everywhere in Tibet is not true. We should have loved to go skiing, but even if we could have repeated our experiment with homemade skis, the distances were too great. We should have needed horses, tents, and servants. Sport in uninhabited regions is a costly business. So we had to content ourselves with climbing expeditions. Our equipment was not exactly professional. We wore army boots and other articles of clothing, surplus stores sold to Tibet by American dealers. They were good enough for our purposes. The Tibetans could not get over their astonishment at the speed with which we completed our tours. Once I had to light a bonfire of incense on a mountain top for my friends to see from the roofs of their houses. Otherwise no one would have believed that we had really got there. Ofsnator and I used to walk in one day as far as our friends' servants did in three. The first Tibetan in whom I managed to create some enthusiasm for mountain walks was my friend Wangjula, who had very good powers of endurance. Later on other friends accompanied us, and all greatly enjoyed the views and took pleasure in the wonderful mountain flowers that we found. My favorite expedition was to a little mountain lake a short day's march from Lhasa. The first time I went there was during the rainy season, when it was feared that the waters would overflow and flood the town. According to an ancient legend, this lake is connected by a subterranean channel with an underground lake said to exist beneath the cathedral. Every year the government used to send monks to propitiate the spirits of the lake with prayers and offerings. Pilgrims, too, used to go there and throw rings and coins into the water. By the lake stood a few stone huts in which one could find shelter. I found that the lake did not threaten the safety of the town in the slightest degree. Even if it had overflowed, no harm would have been done. It was a peaceful, idyllic little place. Herds of wild sheep, gazelles, marmots, and foxes sauntered casually by, and high in the blue the lama gear wheeled his flight. To all these creatures man was not an enemy. No one would dare to hunt in the neighborhood of the holy city. The flora around the lake are of a kind to quicken the pulse of any botanist. Marvelous yellow and blue poppies grow on the shore. They are a specialty of Tibet, which elsewhere you will find only at Kew. These expeditions did not quite satisfy my appetite for sport. I kept wondering what else I could do, and at last the idea came to me to make a tennis court. I managed to interest a good many people in the idea and prepared a list of prospective members of the Lhasa T.C. I also collected some funds in advance. The list of members was very imposing and had an almost international character. There were Indians, Sikkimese, Nepalese, and of course numbers of the young gentlemen of Lhasa. These had hesitated at first about joining, in view of the attitude of the government toward football. But I was able to allay their fears by pointing out that tennis was a sport that did not attract onlookers or cause contention. Even the church must realize that it was an innocent game. Besides, there was already a tennis court at the British legation. I then engaged workmen and got them to level a piece of ground near the river. It was not easy to find the right kind of soil to surface the court with, but in a month it was all ready. I was very proud of the job. We had already ordered nets, rackets, and balls from India, and we organized a small party to start off the Lhasa Tennis Club. There was keen competition among the children to become ball boys. They were fearfully clumsy, having never before had a ball in their hands, but when we invited members of the British legation to play with us, the soldiers of the bodyguard of the Nepalese mission came and fielded the balls for us. It was killing to see them running around in their splendid uniforms. Soon we had collected quite a number of players. Incontestably the best was Mr. Liu, the secretary of the Chinese legation. Then came Mr. Richardson, the British minister, Eghorn Scotsman, slim and tough in his professional work. He had only one hobby, his splendid flower and vegetable garden. When one visited him, one imagined oneself in a garden in fairyland.